Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Sunday, June 14th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. Happy Flag Day to everybody flying the line today. We've got a big one to start with, Alex.
We do, and it's not a flashy one. It's a structural one. There's a four-part series wrapping up over on Liam News, written by a safety analyst named Vincent Bianco, and the thesis is honestly kind of damning.
Lay it out.
So the argument is that the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, has spent years repeating the exact pattern that got Boeing into so much trouble. You have a documented systemic safety problem, and instead of fixing the structural root cause, you apply a surface-level patch. A cosmetic fix. Enough to satisfy the regulatory pressure of the moment.
And then?
And then the underlying problem is still sitting there. So, a few years later, it produces another accident. Bianco calls the final part the pattern that compounds. Voici.
Okay, so this is the thing that gets under my skin, because it's not a Boeing story. It's an institutional story, right? We spent 2 years, 3 years, all of us, pointing at Boeing going, look at the corner cutting, look at the safety culture. And the whole time, the regulator is running the same playbook one level up.
That's exactly his point.
Minimum compliance. You do the least the regulation technically requires, you check the box, you move on. And the structural thing nobody wanted to pay for is still there, source Liam News.
And the counterexample he holds up, the thing he says the industry should be doing instead, is the next generation collision avoidance work. ACAS-X.
Right, and we should spell that out. So most of our listeners are flying behind some version of the Traffic Collision Avoidance System, TCAS. That's the box that gives you the traffic and the climb resolution advisories.
The one that saved an enormous number of lives.
Huge. But it's 1980s logic. It was built around the transponder world of 40 years ago. ASAS-X, the Airborne Collision Avoidance System X, is the rebuild. It's probability-based. It uses a dynamic model instead of the old hard-coded threat tables. And critically, it's designed to fold in newer surveillance, your automatic dependent surveillance broadcast, your ADS-B position data.
And there are variants, right? It's not one box.
That's the part I love. There's ACAS XA for the big transport airplanes, basically the TCAS replacement. There's SHU for unmanned aircraft, the drones, which matters more every single month. There's a version aimed at general aviation. So instead of one rigid system, you've got a family designed for the airspace we're actually going to be operating in, with eVTOLs and uncrewed traffic mixed in.
So Bianco's contrast is, that's what comprehensive looks like. You see a deficiency. Your collision avoidance can't handle the future traffic environment, and you don't bolt a patch onto the old box. You design the replacement architecture.
Versus the minimal compliance modification. Yeah. And look, I'll push back a little on him, because comprehensive is also expensive and slow. ACAS-X has been in development for, what, well over a decade. The Liam TCAS archive basically traces this whole evolution from transponders forward.
Sure.
So the cynic says, of course the regulator reaches for the cheap patch, because the comprehensive fix takes 15 years and a fleet-wide retrofit budget nobody's authorized. The honest version of his argument is that the cheap patch isn't actually cheaper. It just moves the cost downstream onto the next accident.
And that's the compounding. That's the word in the title.
That's the word. Failure, fix, accident. Failure, fix, accident. And each cycle you're paying in hulls and in people, not in dollars.
I'll say, for the working pilot listening, the takeaway isn't doom. ACAS-X is real, it's coming, and it's genuinely better. If you're flying corporate or 135 and you're specking an avionics upgrade in the next few years, this is the trajectory. The old TCAS 2.1 logic is the past.
And it actually plays nicer with ADS-B traffic, which is the environment you're already in. So it's not a hard sell. The hard sell is the institutional habit, not the technology.
Well, and that pattern argument connects directly to something else moving through the FAA right now, on the air traffic side. Source, the air current.
Oh, the airspace intelligence thing.
The air current is reporting the FAA is close to picking a winner for its AI-powered air traffic management tool. And the frontrunner is a Boston company, Airspace Intelligence. They beat out Palantir and Thales, apparently.
Which is a big deal because the two losing names there are giants. Palantir's the defense data behemoth. Thales is one of the biggest avionics and air traffic houses on the planet. And a Boston startup is reportedly out front.
The product's called SMART. It's a predictive machine learning driven traffic management platform and it's meant to be central to the FAA's whole national airspace modernization push.
Okay, so here's where I get both excited and nervous, Alex, and it's the same conversation we were just having.
Go.
The exciting version, predictive traffic flow management, is exactly the kind of comprehensive upgrade the system needs. If the tool can look at weather, demand, and capacity and forecast where the jams are going to form an hour out instead of reacting after they've formed, that's real. That's fewer ground stops, fewer holding patterns, less fuel burned circling.
And the nervous version.
The nervous version is an AI-powered system going into the core of the national airspace system is the highest stakes possible place to do minimum compliance integration, right? This is the thing we were just complaining about. You cannot patch this in. The validation, the human factors, how the controller actually trusts and uses the output. If smart says, reroute this flow, and the controller's instinct says otherwise, who wins and how do you train that?
And these are decision support tools, to be clear. A human controller is still in the loop.
For now, yes, and that's the right design. It's advisory. But I want to know how they certify a learning system whose recommendations can drift as the model updates. That's a genuinely new regulatory problem. We don't have a clean framework for the software gives different advice next quarter because it learned something.
It's a fair point, though I'd say the upside pressure is enormous. The system's straining. Controller staffing's been a chronic problem. The infrastructure's aging. If this tool actually relieves workload,
then it's worth it. I agree. I just want them to do it like ACAS-X and not like the patch. That's my whole thing this morning, apparently.
That's the through line. Comprehensive, not cosmetic.
Put it on a mug.
All right, let's change altitude a bit. There's a stack of stories over on Simple Flying, and a few of them are right in the wheelhouse for the people listening. Source Simple Flying.
Start me with the one that made me actually wince. The Delta jets in the desert.
Yeah, this one's a great operational lesson. Delta Airlines has brand new Airbus A321neos. Delivered, paid for, sitting in desert storage. Not flying. And the reason is the business class seat.
The seat.
The seat. They were designed around the Safran View business class seat. And that seat hit a snag in certification with the FAA. Human factors and other issues. So the seat isn't approved, and you can't fly a revenue airplane with an uncertified seat in it.
This is one of those things that civilians never believe. You've got a perfectly airworthy, brand new narrowbody, and it cannot earn a dime because a piece of furniture is stuck in paperwork. And it's not a small delay. Delta's apparently flying older aircraft with 44 recliner-style seats to cover the routes those neos were supposed to fly.
Which is the hidden cost? You've got capital sitting on the ramp depreciating, and you're burning your older, less efficient metal to cover the gap.
And here's the part that connects, because I can't help myself. Seat certification has become a genuine bottleneck across the industry. These premium seats are mini cabins now. They've got actuators, they've got electronics, doors, they've got to pass 16G dynamic testing, the human factors review. The interiors are now a critical path item on aircraft delivery. That used to be unthinkable.
The seat is the long pole in the tent.
The seat is the long pole, wild.
Staying with the wide body world for a second, there's a nice piece on how cabin crew will rest on the long Boeing 777X flights.
Which the 707X is finally getting close, so this is timely.
So the design. There's an overhead flight crew rest area. Two bunks and two seats, tucked up above. And then a separate cabin crew rest area at the rear with 10 bunks for the flight attendants.
And for the pilots listening who fly augmented long haul, this matters more than it sounds. Certified crew rest is a regulatory thing, not a comfort thing. On ultra-long range ops, your duty time math depends on having a proper, certified bunk so the relief crew can get genuine rest. It's the difference between a legal augmented operation and not.
And the overhead location keeps it out of the revenue cabin, so you're not giving up seats.
Right, every cubic foot up there is real estate. They didn't have to take from paying passengers. It's smart packaging. And honestly, fatigue is a safety system. We talk about TCS and avionics, but a rested relief pilot in hour 15 is a safety system too.
Couldn't agree more. Now, on the business side, there were a couple of pay stories that I know our audience always perks up for. Simple Flying ran the numbers on what Boeing 777 captains actually earn at the top five carriers.
Oh, give me the range.
Roughly 120,000 at the bottom up to about 330,000 gross at the top. Emirates near the top end. But the whole point of the piece is that gross is a lie.
It is. This is the thing. Headline salary and take-home pay are completely different animals once you account for tax structure, housing, cost of living, benefits. A Gulf carrier number that looks enormous because it's tax-free reads very differently than a European number that's taxed hard, but comes with a pension, and you actually like where you live.
And that connects to a discussion that was bubbling on Reddit too, actually, comparing European airline pay against the Middle East and Japan.
Yeah, the European pay opacity thing, it's genuinely hard to compare. KLM, British Airways, Swiss, versus Qatar, versus the Japanese carriers. And European pay is notoriously hard to pin down because so much of it is seniority bans and work rules that don't show up in a headline figure.
So the lesson for anyone weighing a move.
Build the spreadsheet. The whole spreadsheet. Tax, housing, schooling for the kids if you've got them, commuting, currency risk, and what your quality of life actually is on a layover and at home. The gross number on the recruiting flyer is marketing. The net number in a city you can stand is the real job.
Well said. Quick one in the same family. Simple Flying also broke down who actually earns American Airlines Executive Platinum status now under the loyalty points system.
This is a frequent flyer, one more than a pilot one, but it's relevant because so many of us non-rev or pay travel between bases. American moved off button seat miles to loyalty points back in 2022, and the top tier now is basically a spend target, not a flying target.
So the road warrior who flies a lot of cheap fares is worse off, and the person putting spend on the co-branded card is better off.
Which tells you exactly who the airline values now. It's not the miles, it's the wallet. Moving on before I get cynical.
Too late. Let's do a couple of the heritage and hardware pieces, because there were some fun ones. The Boeing 747 SP and Qantas at Wellington.
Oh, I love the SP.
So the 747 SP, Special Performance, was the shortened 747. They took something like 45 to 50,000 pounds of structure out of it, chopped the fuselage down, kept the full wingspan. And Qantas used it to crack Wellington, which has a notoriously short runway.
And this is engineering by subtraction, which I find beautiful. Everybody thinks aircraft development is adding capability. The SP was deliberately taking weight and length away to unlock a performance envelope a standard 747 couldn't touch. Shorter field, longer range, because you've shed all that mass.
Lighter airplane, same wing, same engines, it just leaps off the runway.
It's the hot and high short field special. And for a country like New Zealand, where the geography is brutal, that one airframe decision opened up connectivity that otherwise just didn't exist. Love that airplane. Long nose up sit on the ramp too. Distinctive.
And in the same airplane that rewrote the map category, the 787 Dreamliner piece.
The point-to-point revolution.
Right. The argument is the 787 permanently rewrote long-haul economics. The number they cite is something like 523 new nonstop routes across 85 countries that the airplane made viable.
And this is the real legacy of that airplane, more than the carbon fuselage or the cabin pressure or the big windows, all of which are great. It's that the economics let you skip the hub. You don't have to funnel everybody through a mega connection anymore. A mid-sized city pair that could never fill a 747 can fill a 787 nonstop.
Thin long-haul routes.
Thin long-haul routes become profitable. And once that's true, the whole network map reorganizes. That's a bigger deal than people give it credit for. The hub-and-spoke model was a constraint imposed by the airplanes. The 787 relaxed the constraint.
All right, let's hit the military hardware quickly, because there were three good ones, and there's actually a thread connecting them. Old bombers and new bombers.
The B-21 and the B-52, yes, these are great together.
So first, Northrop Grumman and the B-21 Raider. The piece is basically, Northrop needs to accelerate production because the Air Force is retiring the B-1 Lancer and the B-2 Spirit fleets to make room, and the target keeps growing. Initial orders 100, and there's talk of stretching it toward 145.
And here's the squeeze. You're retiring the bridge before the new bridge is finished. The B-1s and the B-2s are going away on a schedule, and if B-21 production doesn't ramp fast enough, you get a capability gap in the middle. Fewer bombers in the inventory during the transition years. That's the production risk everybody's watching.
And the B-2 is a tiny fleet to begin with. 19-ish airframes.
19. So every one you retire is a real chunk of the stealth bomber force, and the Raider has to backfill it on time. There's not a lot of slack.
Meanwhile, the airplane that refuses to retire, the B-52.
70 years old and getting new engines? I love this.
The Commercial Engine Replacement Program. They're pulling the old Pratt & Whitney TF33 engines and putting on Rolls-Royce F130 turbofans. 30% fuel burn reduction, dramatically less maintenance.
And think about that contrast for a second. You're racing to build a brand new stealth bomber, and at the same time, you're re-engineering a Cold War design from the 1950s to fly into the 2050s or 60s. 100 years of service life on one airframe type is genuinely on the table.
Because the airframe's still good.
The airframe's a tank. It's the engines and the avionics that age out, and 8 ancient engines per airplane is a logistics nightmare. Those TF-33s are out of production, parts are scarce, the fuel burn is awful. New commercial derivative turbofans fix all of it at once. It's the most cost-effective fleet decision the Air Force has, and it lets the B-52 carry the standoff weapon mission while the B-21 handles the stealth penetration. They're complementary, not competitors.
Old and new, side by side. Good thread. Okay, let's get down into the weeds where a lot of our listeners actually live, the pilot community discussions. There's a busy thread of stuff on Reddit this week.
And some of it's serious. Let's lead with the alternator one, because it's a real decision-making case.
Right. So a pilot in a Mooney has an alternator failure during the climb on a visual flight rules cross-country. They divert to the nearest Class C airport, shed the non-essential electrical load, do a rapid descent, land safely. And then the question they're asking the community is, should I have continued on battery instead of diverting?
And I want to be really clear here, because this is a good teaching moment. They made the conservative choice and they landed safely. That's a win. Full stop.
Agreed.
But the question underneath it is excellent because the answer is, it depends entirely on what's actually running off that battery. In day visual conditions, an alternator failure is a time-limited problem, not an immediate emergency. You've got a finite battery, you shed load, radios, lights, anything you don't need, and you've bought yourself, what, maybe 30 minutes to an hour, depending on the battery and the draw?
So diverting to the nearest suitable field is never wrong.
Never wrong. It's the textbook answer. The only thing I gently coach is the rapid descent part. You don't need to panic descend in day visual conditions on an alternator failure. You've got more time than your adrenaline is telling you. Fly the airplane, manage the budget, pick a good field, fly a normal approach. The danger in these isn't the electrical failure, it's the rushed decision the electrical failure provokes.
Now, if that same failure happens in instrument conditions, at night?
Totally different animal. Now your battery is feeding your only means of attitude reference and your radio's in cloud. And that clock is genuinely scary. So the continue or divert answer flips hard based on conditions. In day visual, you have options. In the soup at night, get it on the ground, nearest suitable, no debate.
Great breakdown. And staying with the Mooney world, there's actually a slightly alarming one. A Mooney M20F pilot reporting light white smoke or mist coming up from the cabin floor during a hot weather climb.
Yeah, this one made me sit up. 30 degrees Celsius day, climbing through to 8,500 feet, and they get this fine white smoke or mist from the floor area. Opens the cabin vent, it goes away. Closes the vent, it comes back. Engine gauges, all normal.
So what's your read?
The reassuring read, and the most likely one, is that it's condensation or water vapor. Humid air, temperature and pressure changes, hot day, and you're basically making a little cloud inside the cabin, like the vents on an airliner on a humid day. The fact that it clears with airflow and the engine instruments are all green points that way.
But
you do not assume that, because the failure modes you have to rule out are serious. White smoke could be an electrical issue starting to cook insulation. It could be hydraulic or glycol if there were a heater core involved, though that's less likely in that airplane. And the nightmare one, any possibility of exhaust or carbon monoxide intrusion, because that's colorless, but the heat exchanger and exhaust leaks are a real Mooney-era concern.
So the move is?
The move is, get a carbon monoxide detector in that cockpit if you don't have one. Today, the electronic kind, not the little spot card. And get a mechanic to actually trace the source on the ground before the next flight. It went away when I opened the vent is not a diagnosis, it's a clue. Don't fly it again until somebody's found the source.
Good, firm advice. Let's lighten it up. Because there were a bunch of training community posts too. We had a private pilot checkride prep, a multi-engine struggle, somebody planning a pretty wild work and train schedule.
The 19-year-old, did you see this one?
The ramp agent. Yeah. 19 years old, lead ramp agent at Tampa International, Working 60 hours a week, doing a mechanical engineering degree part-time, and wants to stack private through Certified Flight Instructor, CFI, on top of all of it.
And the question to the community was just, is this doable?
What do you tell them?
I want to honor the ambition because that drive is exactly what gets people through this industry. But I'm going to be honest the way a mentor should be. 60 hours a week of physical ramp work, plus engineering coursework, plus flight training that needs you sharp and rested, something gives. And in flight training, the thing that gives is usually money and consistency.
Because flight training punishes gaps.
It punishes gaps brutally. If you can only fly once every 2 weeks because your schedule's slammed, you spend the first half of every lesson relearning the last one. It gets expensive and demoralizing. So my advice isn't don't, it's sequence it. Maybe knock out the engineering core, keep the ramp job for the paycheck and frankly the industry exposure, and then attack the flight training in a concentrated block when you can fly 2-3 times a week consistently. Pace it. It's a marathon. You're 19. You have time. You don't have to do all of it this calendar year.
And the ramp job's not nothing for a future career.
It's gold, honestly. You're learning the operation from the ground up, literally. That maturity shows up in an interview.
There was also a multi-engine add-on pilot struggling. Instrument approaches in a Piper PA-30 Twin Comanche configuration and stability, with an admitted gap in recent instrument flight experience.
And this is so common, it's almost universal. They've been away from instrument flying, instrument flight rules, IFR, for a while, and now they're trying to fly precise approaches in a twin, which is a higher workload airplane, with rusty procedural fluency. Of course, it's falling apart.
So the fix isn't about the multi-engine part.
Exactly. That's the insight. The struggle isn't the second engine, it's the rust on the instrument scan and the procedures. My honest coaching there is, get the single pilot instrument fundamentals solid first, in a simulator if you can, where it's cheap and you can run approach after approach, rebuild the scan and the flow, then put it in the Twin Comanche. Don't try to fix two problems at once in the most expensive possible classroom.
Configuration discipline in a twin.
Configuration is everything in a twin. Gear flaps, power, on speed, on profile, every time, the same way. If you've got the airplane stabilized and configured at the right point, the approach flies itself. If you're chasing configuration and the needles at the same time, you're behind and it spirals. Stabilize early.
And there was a fun phraseology debate too. Somebody, a non-US pilot, noticing that American pilots tend to say declaring an emergency rather than the three Mayday calls.
Oh, I love this one because both sides think they're right and both sides kind of are.
Lay it out.
So the international standard, the ICAO standard, is Mayday, Mayday, Mayday. That's the formally correct distress call. And the FAA references it too. But in actual US operational practice, you hear pilots key up and say, we're declaring an emergency, constantly. It's cultural. It's just how it evolved here.
Does it matter?
Functionally, the controller's going to treat both exactly the same. They're going to roll the trucks and give you the airspace either way. But here's my actual advice. Say Mayday. Use the word. It's unambiguous, it's recognized worldwide, and it instantly cuts through everything on the frequency. Declaring an emergency works fine domestically, but Mayday, Mayday, Mayday leaves zero room for interpretation. And in the moment you actually need it, that clarity is worth everything. Don't be shy about the word. It exists for that exact moment.
And don't let pride keep you from declaring it all. That's the real killer.
That's the real one. Every accident report with the pilot didn't declare in it. Just declare. The paperwork is nothing. Say the word.
Now, on a much heavier note, there were a couple of military mishaps moving through the community feeds, and we should touch them carefully.
Carefully is right.
A U.S. Navy, actually Marine Corps, FA-18 Hornet went down near Rimrock Lake in Yakima County, Washington. The community posts were tracking it pretty much in real time. 4 Hornets from a squadron leaving Boeing Field, reports of 1 down.
And I want to flag how we handle this, because half of those posts are unverified real-time chatter. We're not going to speculate on cause. We're not going to speculate on the crew's status beyond what's confirmed. That's somebody's family. What we can say is it's a reminder that military training flights operate in that active airspace corridor in the Pacific Northwest constantly. And these are demanding low-altitude, high-performance operations.
And separately, internationally, an Indian Air Force Antonov An-32 transport crashed with 5 fatalities.
The AN-32 has a long and frankly troubled history with the Indian Air Force, including operations into some of the most hostile terrain on Earth, the Siachen region, high Himalayan flying. We'll note it, we'll express condolences, and we'll wait for the actual investigation rather than guessing. 5 people lost. That's the headline that matters.
Well said. Let's bring the energy back up to close out the Reddit segment because there was a lovely Warbird post.
The T-6, yes, give me the T-6.
A pilot flew a 1943 North American T-6 Texan, the Navy designation SNJ-5B, for the first time and just gushed about it. Said the controls were exceptionally light and smooth, responds to the tiniest stick input, ranked it among their favorite flights ever.
And this is the airplane that taught a whole generation to fight. The T-6 was the advanced trainer in World War II. The saying was, if you could fly the T-6, you could fly anything, because it was deliberately a little demanding. That big radial, the torque, the tailwheel. It would teach you to fly properly, or it'd embarrass you.
And 80-something years later, it's still flying.
Still flying, still teaching. There's something about a round engine and a stick that connects you to the whole history of this thing we do. Good on that pilot. That's why we fly.
That's a perfect bridge to our last item, actually, because it's a flying history piece, but a sobering one. There's a video essay out on the Air Ontario crash.
Flight 1863, Dryden. This is a foundational accident.
March 10th, 1989. Air Ontario Flight 1863, a Fokker F-28 Fellowship, tries to depart Dryden, Ontario for Winnipeg. 65 passengers, 4 crew, and it crashes on takeoff.
And the cause, the immediate cause, is ice on the wings. They took off with contamination on the wing, the airplane couldn't fly, and it came down just past the end of the runway.
But the reason this accident is so important isn't the ice itself.
No, it's everything around the ice. This is the one that basically invented the modern way we think about organizational accidents. The investigation, Justice Moshansky led this huge public inquiry in Canada, and instead of just stopping at pilot took off with ice, pilot error, they pulled the whole thread.
And the whole thread was systemic.
The whole thread was systemic. Why didn't he de-ice? Well, the de-icing situation at Dryden was inadequate. Why didn't he shut down and de-ice properly? Because if he shut the engines down, there was no ground power unit to restart them. The auxiliary power unit was inoperative, and there were passengers boarding. So he's trapped between procedures that contradict each other. There were dispatch pressures, scheduling pressures, an airplane with deferred items, an airline that had just merged and had cultural and training gaps.
So the captain is sitting at the end of a chain of decisions that were made long before he ever got in the seat.
That's exactly it. And the provocative framing in that video title, expected to break the law, gets at the idea that the system put him in a position where every available choice was a bad one. The pressures were arranged such that the unsafe action was the path of least resistance. That's not excusing the takeoff. It's understanding that you don't prevent the next one by blaming one pilot. You prevent it by fixing the system that cornered him.
And Sam, that lands us right back where we started this morning.
It does. It's the exact same lesson as the Liam piece. The Moshansky inquiry was the comprehensive fix. It looked past the surface cause, the ice, to the structural cause, the organizational pressures, and it rewrote how the whole industry thinks about safety culture. That's the model. That's what doing it right looks like.
Versus stopping at pilot error, writing one line and waiting for it to happen again.
Versus the patch. Right. 1989 taught us how to do it properly. The question Bianco's asking in 2026 is whether we still remember the lesson.
That's a heck of a thread to tie the whole show together with. Comprehensive, not cosmetic. Look past the surface to the structure.
Failure, fix, accident, or actually break the cycle. The choice is the same every single time.
All right, that's going to do it for Flight Logic Brief on this Sunday, June 14th. Whether you're flying the line today, sitting reserve, or studying for that check ride, and we know some of you are, fly safe, fly sharp, and declare early if you need to.
Say the word, Mayday, and put a carbon monoxide detector in your airplane. That's my homework for everybody.
Good homework. For Sam, I'm Alex.
And for Alex, I'm Sam. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
Tailwinds, everybody.